أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد والثناء لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening and the return of our Imam, please recite the salawat. For his health and well-being, recite the second one louder. Insha'Allah, each and every one of us becomes his true companion, his soldier, one of those who gives their lives in protection of the Imam of our time. Recite the third one even louder. Insha'Allah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accepts from all of us the aza, the commemorations that we've all been part of in this center and in all other centers globally for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Recite a salawat. We've been talking about what we understand to be a very important concept, and that is to remember the call of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein and to consider it a call that is alive today, and to learn, discuss, think about what our responsibility towards it is today. The call of هَلْ مِنْ نَاصِرٍ يَنْصُرُنِي, the call that is supposed to wake us up thinking about the circumstances in which the Imam was in at that time when he made that call. No one responding to that call. Today we should be thinking along the same lines. Are we responding to that call today? And the person that we would be responding to would be the continuation of Imamah, the Imam of our time. Ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu sharif wa ruhi wa arwahu al-alamin lahu al-fida. How do we do this? What is it that we need to do? We talked about some distractions that prevent us from wanting to respond to that call, and we talked about some of the things that we need to do to inshallah overcome those distractions. But besides that, what are some positive elements we need to have in us? If we want to embark on this journey, if we want to be effective, if we want to truly respond to the call of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, what are some of the qualities that we need to have? What are some of the practices that we need to make sure we take in and we make sure that we're able to contribute in that way? One of the things that we see is that in these lectures, or in any lecture, during the month of Muharram, during the month of Ramadan, when a speaker comes, or we listen to speakers, or because there is a hype of some sort, we are emotionally, spiritually feeling a bit more motivated, we decide to do certain things. We want to do a lot of different things. Then when the hype is gone, and so is the motivation, we end up doing almost nothing. This happens very often. We go to a community, we see people, youth, elderly, different people. They're very excited to do work and they talk about it. So what should we do? This, that, the other. It's Muharram, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, هَلْ مِنْ نَاصِرٍ يَنْصُرُنِي, let's do it. After the 10 days or after Muharram, then it's business as usual until next Muharram, where maybe we'll end up in another majlis, in another program. Maybe we'll get that motivation again. And sometimes we even start something. We get together, brothers, let's do something. Sisters, let's do something. Let's start something. Let's start these classes. Let's start this program. Let's start this organization. We need books. For example, I'm just throwing out examples. How much literature do we have in the English language? You want to study Islamic history, what do you refer to? Do you have any English literature on Islamic history? Whatever speaker comes gives you a whole lot about Islamic history. And each speaker comes and gives you a different version. Okay. And what do people do? Just take whatever is said to them. Why? Because there's no reference. Where is the reference? Where do you go to check and see if this is there or not? How much literature do we have? The leader recently, a few months ago, well, it's almost a year actually, since he released this letter to the youth in Western countries. In it he said to the people, to the youth, refer to the original sources of Islam. Right? Don't take it from me, those who looked at the letter. Ayatollah Khamenei said a few things. One of the lines that he had in there was this. Don't take it from me, go to the original sources of Islam and study them for yourself. Don't listen to me or the media, go to the sources yourself. Okay. The sources are in Arabic. How are people supposed to refer to that? There needs to be translation. Okay, some brothers and sisters, let's do this. Let's start helping, contributing towards translation. They make that intention, for instance, or whatever other goal it is that they set out to accomplish. They go start to talking to people. First thing they come up with is probably, we need a budget. Okay, let's go talk to people. You talk to a few people and nobody's willing to contribute, and that's the end of it. Done. It's over. Motivation was there. We did a little something. We hit the first roadblock. We're done. So sometimes we don't even seriously start. Sometimes when we start on something that we realize, okay, let's answer the call of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. The people in Kufa, let's use that example. Muawiyah passed away. They heard the news. Abu Abdullah has gone to Mecca. They hear that news. They start writing letters to Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. When it got difficult, they were there, they participated, they came forward, they wrote the letters, they sent the letters. When Muslim ibn Aqil came over, they went over to him, they pledged allegiance, 18,000 people. That's a lot of people. Came over, they pledged allegiance. That was against the rules. They took that upon themselves. But when the times got a little more difficult, when they start hitting roadblocks, people stop, they quit, they give up. The first quality we want to talk about, and want to use some examples from the Ahlul Bayt and some of their followers throughout history, we seriously need to learn this lesson from them, is the quality of determination. We've got to have a strong will. We've got to be determined. Azm. It's one of those qualities that unfortunately we miss out on. If we want to be of those who answer the call of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn today, we want to answer the call of the Imam of our time today. We want to be part of that movement. like some of the others who are, we've got to develop this quality. Otherwise, we're getting nowhere. We're really going to get nowhere. Some examples, I think we all understand this with regards to the Ahlul Bayt, but we need to talk about some of those examples. Look at it and take some inspiration from these stories. Learn from the Ahlul Bayt. The Ahlul Bayt are role models. We're supposed to look up to them. Let's look at Amir al-Mu'mineen, for example. We'll go over three of our imams just briefly. Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Hassan and Imam al-Husayn, salamullah alayhim ajma'in. So did Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen, during the time of the Holy Prophet, the way the Holy Prophet treated him, the way the Holy Prophet respected him, the way he told people to respect Amir al-Mu'mineen, as we all know, is unprecedented. This didn't happen towards anyone else. Amir al-Mu'mineen was clearly respected and honored by the Holy Prophet beyond anyone else. Very clear. Right? Anytime Amir al-Mu'mineen went out on an expedition, on a journey, and the Holy Prophet was in Medina, when Amir al-Mu'mineen got back, the Holy Prophet made sure that he goes outside the city to receive him, embrace him, bring him to the city. Anytime anyone said anything wrong against Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Holy Prophet made sure, he made it clear that that's not true about him. Some people went to him, some of those who ran away or wanted to run away in some of those battles. Some of the people who ran away in the battle of Uhud, when the Holy Prophet told Amir al-Mu'mineen to stay back in one of the battles, they went to him and said, oh, the Holy Prophet is telling him to stay back. Trying to degrade him, using that. And that's when the Hadith al-Manzala was said. The Holy Prophet said to Amir al-Mu'mineen, is it not enough that أَنْتَ مِنِّي بِمَنْزِلَةِ هَارُونَ مِنْ مُوسَى إِلَّا أَنَّهُ لَا نَبِيَّ بَعْدِي. So plenty of instances you see that. In the story of Ghadir, you see the Holy Prophet holding the hand of Amir al-Mu'mineen up in the air and telling everyone, مَنْ كُنْتُ مَوْلَاهُ فَهَذَا عَلِيٌّ مَوْلَاهُ.
صَلُّ عَلَى مُحَمَّدْ وَآلِ مُحَمَّدْ.
Making everyone, according to some of the accounts at least, come over and even pledge allegiance by shaking his hands for the men and saying, As-salamu alaykum, Amir al-Mu'mineen. He said all of that. On his deathbed, the Holy Prophet asked for Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen moved close and the Holy Prophet said a few words in his ear. These were very, very important moments at the time or of the life of the Holy Prophet. Just imagine a leader whispering in someone's ear. Everyone wants to know what's going on there. That itself shows a very close relationship between the Holy Prophet and Amir al-Mu'mineen. And you know, you have some of those guys that are really interested in what the Holy Prophet is telling Amir al-Mu'mineen. Very curious, and curiosity is truly killing them. So they ask Amir al-Mu'mineen, what did the Holy Prophet tell you? Amir al-Mu'mineen said, he opened 1,000 gates of knowledge, each of which opens 1,000 gates of knowledge. In just a few minutes there. The Holy Prophet went out of his way to show that. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, during the time the Holy Prophet is most respected, he is considered and announced to be the Khalifa of the Holy Prophet. What happens after the Holy Prophet passes away? Amir al-Mu'mineen has a certain responsibility. He has an obligation. He is an imam. Right? What does he do with it? That responsibility after the demise of the Holy Prophet. Do people respect that? We know they didn't. People didn't respect it. People went and pledged allegiance with someone else eventually. It's a long story. I hope you've heard the lengthy story about how that happened. It's a very important story. Saqifa, who set it up, why they set it up, who said what, how did it end up being an allegiance pledged to Abu Bakr, what did the Holy Prophet do beforehand, had he made it clear, had he not made it clear, all those important issues. But the end result is after the demise of the Holy Prophet, people did not respect the words of the Holy Prophet in regards to Amir al-Mu'mineen. He's supposed to be Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, the one who leads. That's what he's supposed to be. Do people give him that position? No, they don't give him that position. Not only do they not give him that position, they don't even respect the sanctity of his house. What is Amir al-Mu'mineen supposed to be doing there? I'm talking about roadblocks, anything greater than that? He has a responsibility to guide people. What does Amir al-Mu'mineen do? We're talking about determination. The determination Amir al-Mu'mineen has in guiding the people. Some of the biggest and greatest roadblocks. Not only does no one support him, when he goes to the doors of the Ansar, 3 nights in a row with the lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha, along with Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn, knocking on their doors, talking to them about their pledge of allegiance in Ghadir, them deciding or saying to Amir al-Mu'mineen at the very least at that time that they will be coming in support of Amir al-Mu'mineen the next day, and then Amir al-Mu'mineen waking up the next day and no one's there. Okay. 3 nights in a row. He needed 40 people. People not coming. You're talking about roadblocks? Not only did people not come, people came to the door and burnt the door down. What did Amir al-Mu'mineen do here? The common notion that a lot of us Shia understand about that situation there is that Amir al-Mu'mineen said, okay, you don't want me, I'm going to remain silent. I just won't take to the sword. That's what we hear. In a sense, that sounds like someone that is upset. Isn't Amir al-Mu'mineen supposed to be the Imam? It's a responsibility, right? What did Amir al-Mu'mineen do here? The common notion that Amir al-Mu'mineen went to his house and remained there for the duration of 25 years before people came to his door is an incorrect understanding. That's not what Amir al-Mu'mineen did. Amir al-Mu'mineen mentions this in Nahjul Balagha. He said, I decided initially not to interfere, just to allow things to move along, as long as the only one that is oppressed in the Muslim and amongst the Muslim Ummah is me, as long as it's just me that's been oppressed, that's fine. I won't say anything. I won't take to the sword. I won't do anything. But that's not for 25 years. This is really important. I hope we take this lesson from Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen not only did not fight against them, he said, when I saw the matter of riddah, when I saw that people were coming and rejecting faith, abandoning faith, some of the new Muslims, some of the ones who had become Muslim recently in the last year or two, some of those tribes, there was an incident that's called riddah. They became murtad. They said, well, the Prophet has passed away. We don't even believe in it any longer, and so on and so forth. There was a lot of threats. Amir al-Mu'mineen said, I realize that Islam needs me. What did Amir al-Mu'mineen do? He came forward and helped that community that rejected him. If he's determined to guide, roadblocks come in the way, he doesn't stop there. Some of the signs for this, this is really important. Sometimes what happens is we we decide to do some work, okay, we decide we have an obligation, we have a responsibility, we got to do something, we go to a center, we go to a group, we form a group, we say a few things, people don't accept it, we decide, okay, you know what, I'm not going to work with this group any longer. Is that how we work? Is that how we do things? Learn from Amir al-Mu'mineen. No, Amir al-Mu'mineen went and helped the same people that usurped his right. Of course, not helping them, helping Islam. But the only way to help Islam is to be there, give them support. Another example of it is during the Shura, the six-man Shura, after the death of the second Khalifa. After the death of the second Khalifa, he had appointed six individuals that he said are supposed to decide amongst themselves who the next Khalifa is going to be. Amir al-Mu'mineen didn't say, what are you talking about? He didn't say, I'm not going to come forward, because he didn't have to. He could have said, I don't have anything to do with this. You guys didn't want me, I'm not with you. That's not what he did. He was there. He was participating. Even after in that shura, they decided to appoint and vote for Uthman as the next Khalifa, Amir al-Mu'mineen still did not stand aside and say, I have nothing to do with the Ummah of the Holy Prophet. You guys do whatever you wish. No, Amir al-Mu'mineen stayed there. And he made sure he contributed. He came forward. He gave his opinions. He stood his grounds according to an understanding of the khutbah he gave. When people came to his door and begged him to be the Khalifa, he said, I rather remain a wazir. In other words, his role at that time, he considered his role to be that of wizara. In other words, being a consultant to the Khalifa. So I'd rather be that. He had such a position. Now this concept of Amir al-Mu'mineen being a participating individual in that community, giving his guidance, helping the community still move in the right direction despite the fact that they said, we don't want you as the Khalifa. Okay? This is one example of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Whether it was during the time of the Holy Prophet where he was given that respect, or they came to his door and they burned the door down, or during the time when they came over and they asked him, in all of those stages, the determination of Amir al-Mu'mineen to lead the Muslim Ummah as the Imam of the Muslimin is there. He doesn't give up, no matter what the circumstances are. He does not give up. Imam al-Mujtaba continues that. Imam al-Mujtaba continues that. A lot of us don't know that history. I'm giving part of it, a very brief explanation of it, and I leave it to you to try to go and find literature. And if there isn't, try to be part of creating literature, translations and so on. What we know of the history of the Imam al-Mujtaba, those of us who know anything about that history, is that there's a truce between Imam al-Mujtaba and Muawiyah. That's pretty much all we know. A six-month government, after which he accepted the truce, and that's it. That's all we know about the Imamah of Imam al-Mujtaba. That's part of the Mazlumiyyah of that Imam. I've said this a number of times, and every time I start talking about Imam al-Mujtaba, I remember, because I forget sometimes, remember how mazlum Imam al-Mujtaba is, that even the Shia of the Ahlul Bayt are almost clueless about the history of Imam al-Mujtaba. One of the five, okay, Ashab al-Kisa, we barely have any information about this Imam. What did Imam al-Mujtaba do? First of all, he was determined to fight Muawiyah. He made that very clear. He tried to gather troops to go and fight Muawiyah. Despite all the difficulties, there were very difficult times. Amir al-Mu'mineen had tried doing that. It wasn't working out. It wasn't like Imam al-Mujtaba said, you know what, I'm not going to do this. It didn't work. No, he was determined. That was the right thing to do. He was determined to go, move forward, and make sure he fights Muawiyah, continuing the same line of Amir al-Mu'mineen. But after he started trying, things got worse and worse, to the extent where the governors or the commanders of Imam al-Mujtaba, one after the other, were giving up on him, giving in, unfortunately, betraying the Imam. These are some of those distractions that we talked about. God forbid, someone who's working for the Imam because of some money, because of cash. Thank you very much. Say the salawat, please. Some price, some thousands or millions of gold coins or silver coins, whatever they were. There are some people that have a price. It may not be a low price, but if you pitch the right figure, they'll be willing to do anything. There were those commanders of Imam al-Mujtaba that went with that, and eventually things didn't work out for the war, for the battle. Imam al-Mujtaba went along with that truce that you've all have heard. But what happened after the truce? What did the Imam do after the truce? Did he give up his responsibility? Did he give up his obligations? Did he stop leading? There is an abundance of evidence that the movement of the Ahlul Bayt continued during those 20 years between the truce of Imam al-Mujtaba and the movement of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. In fact, it was because of that continuation, because of the struggle, the underground movement that Imam al-Mujtaba created. He trained Shia in Kufa and wherever else he could find them to start a movement that would have matured in the year 70, according to the Ahlul Bayt. He didn't say, well, you guys don't want this. A roadblock, we stop. No, they continued. All of the Ahlul Bayt. Imam al-Husayn continued that. You know the story with Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, maybe a little more, hopefully a little more than we do of Imam al-Mujtaba's story. After he came to know Imam al-Husayn, after he came to know that people were not supporting him, he didn't give up. He didn't give up the revolution. This was the right thing to do. He continued with it, no matter how difficult things got. Say salawat, please. The recent times examples that we can think of, we've got to learn this lesson of having that self-determination, that willpower, that strength in us, that no matter what the difficulties are, no matter what happens in our life, we continue. If we have that, we're going to get somewhere. This is why I'm stressing on this, brothers and sisters. I hope that some of us, at the very least, are able to take this on board. It takes one or two individuals who are determined to create a movement as big as the revolution. Look at the example of the Islamic Revolution. There were plenty of roadblocks, plenty of them. When Imam al-Khomeini started his movement in Qum, whether it was attacking Faydiya, the school, house of students, killing them, throwing the students off of the second floor, stabbing them, and what have you, after, this is the first year of the beginning of that revolution, what the Imam, the late Imam Khomeini started. People within the Hawza were telling Imam Khomeini, what are you doing? Who's going to be answerable for the blood of all these people who are losing their lives? A whole lot of pressure within the Hawza. Imam Khomeini continued. He was imprisoned. Imam Khomeini continued. Sent to exile to Turkey, he was told you can't even, that was what the rule was. I don't know if it still is or not. The law in Turkey was he wasn't able to wear the hamama outside. If you've seen the images in Turkey when Imam Khomeini was there for the 6 months he was there, he wasn't allowed to wear it. Turkey said, we don't want Imam Khomeini, go to some other country. He had to go to Iraq. He continued. After 14 years in Iraq, Saddam was now in power and said, you know, we're not going to allow Imam Khomeini to be in Najaf any longer. Imam Khomeini's words were these, that if I have to travel from airport to airport and no country allows me, I will do that and I will continue the revolution, not give up. He came to Iran. People did not believe that this revolution is going to succeed. In a matter of 10 days, the regime was overthrown. The new government came in. Problem after problem started after the success of the revolution. Brothers and sisters, we owe a whole lot to this man and all of those who gave their lives in that revolution to bring to life the movement of the Ahlul Bayt again. Okay. If you and I are sitting here in Imam Hussein Islamic Center in Sydney, we owe a whole lot to Imam Khomeini and to all those shuhada that gave their lives and to those who are fighting today and all those who are helping the cause today, especially the leader of it, Ayatollah Khamenei. Okay. All of us owe, all of them, our iman, our Islam, and our understanding of Islam, and our beating of our chests and commemorations of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. They revived it. Problem after problem after problem. One of those problems was the imposed war. 8-year war. With all those sanctions. Believers within the country were coming to Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Khomeini has this line. There's plenty of memories that plenty of people have, but this one, which was recently in one of the last sessions that Ayatollah Khomeini had, was repeated. Someone read it, and Ayatollah Khomeini had an addition to it. He said that when the war began, some of the technicians and commanders in the Air Force came to me and said, look, these are the realities in our Air Force. These are the planes we have. This is the maintenance that they require. These are the technical abilities that we have. This is what they require. We don't have this, that, the other. We can only fly these planes for another 2, 3, whatever the figure was, weeks though. It wasn't even a month, if I remember correctly. That's all we can do. So these people come to Ayatollah Khomeini. Ayatollah Khomeini takes that. He said, I was very worried. I went to Imam Khomeini and I said that. I said, look, this is what they're telling me. We can't continue with this. We just don't have the technical support that is required to get these planes moving off the ground. Imagine a leader, right, in the midst of war. The Air Force is one of the few that has the ability to allow us to continue this war, this battle, with the limited facilities, with the limited resources that they had. This was a resource that they had from before the revolution, because things were not being given to the Islamic Republic after the revolution. The sanctions, these are not new sanctions. Right after the revolution, you had those, especially when the war began. So they're coming, his own people are coming and telling him, this is the situation. These are very, very serious roadblocks, brothers and sisters. The determination of these people, these followers of the Ahlul Bayt, learning from the Ahlul Bayt, has kept the movement going. Now Khomeini told, according to Allah Khomeini, he said, he told me, don't worry about it. Go tell them to continue. And up to today, those same jets are still flying. Okay. They're still being used. If we have the determination to continue, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to support us. This is, whoever wants to try to answer the call of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, whoever wants to try to answer the call of the Imam of our time, whoever wants to support them, has got to learn this lesson. Otherwise, we're not serious about this. We get a hype, we're motivated, we're going to go do something, we hit the first roadblock, we're done. We're not going anywhere. It is the likes of Imam Khomeini, the likes of the people in resistance, that are keeping this movement going. We want to join it, we got to learn that lesson, determination. It doesn't matter what happens. It does not matter. It has got to continue. Our effort has got to continue until the moment of death. If we're ready to make that pledge with Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, Bismillah. We're ready to say that to the Imam of our time, inshallah, let's begin. If we're not, if we haven't learned that lesson, let's not try. Let's not give hopes to anyone. And inshallah, all of us have that. How can we have that determination? What allows us to have that determination? What makes us unshakable despite all the difficulties, all the roadblocks, no matter what they are? There's one element. Ikhlas. The motivation and the intention being for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's the only thing that's going to keep us going. That's the only thing that's going to keep us going. Anything that connects with Allah, Allah is unlimited, infinite. That which is connected with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to be unlimited and infinite. It does not matter what happens, that determination will be there. If it's not divine, if we don't have that ikhlas, if we're not doing things for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we don't keep that up, it's not going to be there. This is the only factor. We need that determination. Now, we need it in all dimensions of our life. We're talking about the movement, joining Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. For those who are looking at our personal lives as well, that's also something that we need. For our spiritual development, we need that determination. Without that determination, we start one day, we're done the next day. As soon as we hit a couple roadblocks, difficult times, tough temptations, we fail a couple times, that's it. Determination is required. Where do we get that from? Ikhlas. Make the intention that we're doing this for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And constantly remind ourselves that this is for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If that's there and that remains with us, nothing can shake us. Nothing can take away that determination. In all dimensions of our life. Which inshallah at some other time we can try to address, because we have various dimensions that are in need of this. Which, as I said, we'll leave for some other time inshallah. Assalamu alaykum ya Abu Abdullah. Assalamu alaykum ya وموضع الرسالة ومختلف الملائكة ومهبط وعدنا الرحمن وخزان العلم ومنتهى الحلم. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, it was in your homes that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed us with guidance and revelation. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you. Angels descend upon you day in and day out. الشهيد بكربلاء عطشانا my beloved oppressed Imam, the Imam that was slaughtered by the shores of the Euphrates. صلى الله عليك. Let's take our hearts to the plains of Karbala. These are the last nights of the household of the Holy Prophet. Imagine the women and children, the companions of Abdullah. Eventually they're preparing for the moment of their farewell with the Ahlul Bayt. صلى الله عليك يا مظلوم. images in Karbala. But for the sake of Abu Abdullah, protecting him, lost their arms in Karbala. One of them, all of us know, is Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. But there's another individual, much younger than Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, that also gave his hands to protect Abu Abdullah. When the horse of Abu Abdullah came to the tent, without a rider, the women and children saw the horse, thinking Hussein is back. When they saw there's no rider on the horse, Zainab, who was protecting the children, lost control. While she was looking for her brother, her nephew Abdullah ibn Hassan saw an opportunity. When he saw one of the enemies standing above the body of Abdullah, raising a sword to strike his uncle Imam al-Hussein, Abdullah ran towards Abdullah al-Hussein. Zainab tries to stop him but is not able to. He arrives over the body of Abdullah. He turns to the enemy and says, "Ya Abdullah, I will not allow you to strike my uncle." But he has no shield to protect his uncle. He doesn't even have a sword to extend. The only things he has are his arms. He extends his hands. The enemy strikes. La 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 la. Abdullah's arms are hanging. Imam al-Hussein, ruhi lahu al-fida, hugs Abdullah, embraces him, holds his hands. Abdullah, it's very difficult that you call upon your uncle and he's not able to help. While Abu Abdullah is stroking the hair of Abdullah, the Maloon Harmala shoots an arrow. Ala la'natullah ala al-qawm al-zalimin.